Luisa Gonzalez Cachon had tried to get a good night's sleep, but even if nerves hadn't kept her awake, the voices in the car engines would have. Hey, my friends, how you doing? Keith Tyler here, bringing you the Mystery Hour here on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Very, very grateful that you tuned in. Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine and Twist Phelan bring us our first story, and it's called The Border. Luisa waded into her ankles. The chill shocked her. She'd expected the water to be warmer. Clutching her paddle, she clambered into the camouflage print raft and took her seat on the bow tube, the other five in the group following suit. Arranging themselves three to a side, no one spoke. A breeze rattled the branches of shrubs nudging the river's edge. Wispy clouds slid across the nearly full moon. The smuggler stepped into the stern and jerked the mooring line free. The raft drifted forward, wobbling slightly. Luisa tightened her grip on the paddle, breathing deeply into her chest. She didn't know how to swim. The raft slipped into the river's current, and wind ruffled Luisa's hair. In other circumstances, it might have been pleasant. "Right side, paddle!" the smuggler ordered, his harsh whisper barely audible above the water's slap and popple. The men across from Luisa complied. The raft pivoted 90 degrees. "Now, everybody, paddle!" the smuggler said, his voice still low. Luisa thrust her blade into the water and pulled. Unexpected elation coursing through her as the raft glided ahead. "Keep it up," the smuggler said, then chuckled low in his throat. "Dig or drown, amigos, dig or drown." Luisa Gonzalez Cachon had tried to get a good night's sleep, but even if nerves hadn't kept her awake, the voices and car engines resonating through the thin walls and windows of the border motel would have. She'd gone to bed fully dressed, a folded fast food carton wedged under the door for security. Now, having eaten the last of the tamales she bought from a food truck, she waited with the rest of the group in the designated spot beside the gas station as the sun declined behind the trees. A heavy coat, earth-toned as it directed, was tied around her waist in preparation for the journey to cooler climes. Over her shoulder was slung a loaded backpack, stuffed with clothes and a few toiletries. A six-pack of small water bottles was at her feet. Luisa thought of her mother, who'd left the cinder-block house with the tin roof Luisa's abuelo had built north of Cancun. Far from the opulent hotel zone, in the neighborhood without running water and paved streets and sometimes electricity, to ride a bus to the Mexico-Texas border. Lacking money to pay a smuggler, Luisa's mother had crossed into the U.S. on her own, fording the Rio Grande at night and walking through the desert until she hitched a ride with a church group to San Antonio. She stayed in the States for 16 years, working as a hotel maid under someone else's Social Security number before Luisa's abuelo's final illness compelled her to return to the cinderblock house where she'd lived since. "Oh, I am too old to cross again," she'd say whenever Luisa asked. "La migra would catch me." When Luisa was young, kids would play La Migra, a game named after the slang for immigration officers tasked with rounding up the undocumented for deportation. A combination of tag and hide-and-seek, kids played workers, hid while the one who played La Migra tried to find them. If tagged by La Migra, the worker was out. Luisa remembered the long, tense minutes of waiting in her hiding place, the gut wrench of discovery, the screaming sprint away as she tried to avoid getting caught. She hadn't liked the game. Luisa's mother was 26 when she came to the United States, the same age Luisa was now. If her mother could make the crossing, so could Luisa. Luisa switched her backpack to her other shoulder and touched the pouch that hung under her shirt, reassuring herself the money was still there. She wished it were more. A trip across the border cost $2,000. Paying the smuggler had taken almost all of her savings. "Are you running from a cartel or a bad husband?" Andre asked. Born in Haiti, the 24-year-old had told Luisa he was crossing the border to get away from gun violence. Drawn by his French accent, she'd offered him one of her bottles of water when she saw that he hadn't brought any. Luisa shook her head. "Neither. I'm doing this for my little boy." Luisa thought back to the day of Jorge's diagnosis. She'd left the doctor's office in a daze, clutching the informational pamphlet. In children with diabetes, the body's immune system, which normally fights harmful bacteria and viruses, mistakenly destroys insulin-producing islet cells in the pancreas. Insulin performs the critical job of moving sugar, glucose, from the bloodstream to the body's cells for energy. Without insulin, sugar builds up in the bloodstream, eventually leading to death. So the missing hormone needs to be replaced via injections or an insulin pump. Unlike medications designed to treat adult diabetes, Glucosus maintained Jorge's insulin at a constant level. Una droga milagrosa, Luisa's mother called it, a miracle drug. Monthly injections kept Luisa's 6-year-old son as healthy as all the other children at his school. The price of Glucosus was subsidized by the government, making it affordable for people like Luisa, but then things changed. "Just so you know, next time the price will be higher," the pharmacist had told Luisa when she picked up Jorge's latest glucosus refill. He quoted a figure greater than what Luisa earned in a year. Luisa gaped at him. "What? Why?" "Well, the company that makes it pulled glucosus from the subsidy program. They say they can't keep up with orders now that all the Gordos Ricos want it too." He spread his hands. "It's good business. Sell your stuff to the people who will pay the most for it."
I still don't understand."
"If you're non-diabetic and take glucosus, you lose weight with no side effects," the pharmacist said. Children, like Jorge, needed the drug to stay alive, but rich fat people were buying it up so they can look good? Luisa couldn't believe it. How could the government let this happen?
"The new price is crazy. I can't afford it," she said.
The pharmacist made a sympathetic face. "Well, you'll have to switch Jorge back to Insultes." Luisa scowled.
"You know Insultes doesn't work well in kids. If Jorge had kept taking it, he'd have ended up in renal failure. Plus, it has to be injected every day. Jorge hated shots, still cried every time Luisa administered them."
"It wouldn't be long-term. They say there'll be a glucosus generic in..." The pharmacist consulted his computer. 2 years.
2 years? Are you kidding? Jorge's kidneys won't last that long. He'll be on dialysis waiting for a transplant."
Luisa raked a hand through her hair. She felt like crying.
"What am I supposed to do?"
The pharmacist glanced around. No one was nearby. He leaned toward her. "You didn't hear this from me, but you could try buying it across the border. They're already selling the generic there. It's even OTC.
"They sell it over the counter?"
"Yeah. You don't even need a script, but you have to be careful when you buy it. It's on the banned list."
"It's banned?"
"It's illegal to sell it to non-citizens. And it's for sure illegal to bring it back here. Still, if it were my kid..." He shrugged. 6 months of shots cost about the same as lunch at McDonald's.
Across the border? It wasn't the first time Luisa had considered going north. With its better schools and housing, freedom from violence and moneyed groups who controlled the system, and now, affordable medicine for Jorge? Luisa left the pharmacy and went home, where she began to plan. Luisa had arrived at the border town yesterday, 3 weeks after her conversation with the pharmacist. She now stood with 6 people she'd met half an hour earlier, including one who made his living breaking the laws of 2 countries. The smuggler's name was Leo. As the group listened to his instructions on how to get across the border, Luisa was struck by the similar looks of determination on everyone's face. While each person was crossing for his or her own reasons, they all shared the same resolve. "Time to go," Leo said. The group arranged itself into a single file line and began walking, quickly leaving the town behind. Subdivisions of homes became occasional houses, became no buildings at all. After an hour, they were alone on what appeared to be a rarely used dirt road. While they walked, clouds had gathered overhead, scattered flakes of snow drifted down. Luisa had never seen them in real life. Tipping back her head, she felt a few of the icy particles drop onto her tongue, imagining Jorge trying to catch them in his small hands. She found her knit hat in her backpack and pulled it on, then zipped up her coat to the collar. She'd read that because of climate change, snow was falling in the autumn, even in the desert. Maybe it would keep La Migra away. "Global warming has turned everything upside down," Leo said, coming up beside her. "Cold winter, it's supposed to be hot, raining where it's supposed to be dry. I heard there's a blizzard coming in Las Vegas." "Hmm," Luisa said. Well aware of the horror stories of robbery and rape by strugglers, Luisa had planned to avoid the tall man with angular cheekbones who reminded her of the Jesus statue in La Iglesia de Santa Teresa, her church at home. But after seeing him give a handful of raisins to the oldest one in their group and a band-aid to another with blisters, she'd relaxed her guard a bit. "Are you ready for the river?" Leo said. "Yes," Luisa hoped he didn't hear the quiver in her voice. "Good," he cracked again. "Dig or drown, amiga." Luisa's answering smile was stiff. As a non-swimmer, she could get nervous around a kiddie pool, but crossing via water lessened the odds of being stopped by border services. And while she might be afraid of the river, she was terrified of La Migra. This wasn't a children's game. Getting caught meant arrest and deportation many months before she could save up another smuggler's fee, and many months of Jorge doing without glucosus. But still, the river? Have you ever had someone, drown? I mean, for real? "No, chica," Leo had dropped his jocular tone. "No one has drowned on a crossing with me." The next question lay heavily in her mouth, like a stone. Luisa worked her jaw, trying to push out the words. She finally blurted, Has anyone been caught by La Migra?" But by then, Leo had moved away, rejoining the rest of the group. Luisa kept walking by herself. A car engine fumbled faintly behind them. "Get down!" Leo ordered in a harsh whisper. As he taught them, everyone scattered to either side of the road, hurrying to find hollows in the earth where they could lie face down and their neutral-colored clothing would help them blend in. The engine grew louder. Luisa shut her eyes, a holdover from paying La Migra. If she couldn't see them, they couldn't see her. But as the vehicle rolled past, tires crunching on frosty gravel, she peeked through her fingers. Her muscles went rigid with fear at the sight of a white Ford or pickup, its headlights cutting through the dusk. Her body only relaxed when her brain registered the truck had no light bar on its roof, no insignia on its doors. It wasn't La Migra.
Oh, when the pickup was out of sight, Leo gave the all-clear whistle, and the group members clambered to their feet, brushing dirt from their clothes, smiling and nodding as the tension ebbed.
"Let's go," Leo said. "We need to be at the river by moonrise."
As the group trudged on, Andre caught up with Luisa.
"Bono dies," he said.
When she found out Andre spoke French, Luisa had asked him to practice with her as they walked. He'd agreed, pleased to learn some Spanish in return.
"Try again," Luisa said. "Buenos dias."
Andre repeated the greeting. His pronunciation improved.
"Your turn."
"Bonjour, monsieur," Luisa said.
Andre's square white teeth flashed.
"Mademoiselle, your accent is très bien."
They continued their back and forth in whispers for a few minutes before Andre stopped to adjust his shoe. Luisa continued head down, concerned about tripping. Evening had descended, and she felt as though she were in a black velvet-lined box with the stars like spy holes poked through the top. Another hour passed. The road curved around a stand of trees and came to an abrupt end. Leo pulled up.
"This is the spot," he said.
The wind went silent for a moment as though it were catching its breath, and Luisa heard gentle lapping. Through a break in the foliage, she glimpsed a swath of broad water. She also saw a bridge several hundred feet to the right, 12 stories tall. It had thick cement pillars topped with horizontal steel girders illuminated by bulbs of pitiless white. It straddled the river, making for easy passage between the two countries, at least for those with proper documents and intentions.
"Wait here," Leo told the group.
As he walked toward the surrounding bushes, Luisa saw him pull a flask from his jacket and take a swig. She wondered if he'd been drinking the whole time they'd been walking. Minutes later, Leo reappeared, carrying a half dozen paddles and dragging a large tarp behind him. Rubber squeaked in protest as it scraped over the rocky earth. He handed out the paddles and spread out the tarp, revealing it as an inflatable raft in a camouflage print. After connecting what looked like a mini accordion via a plastic hose to the valve on the raft, he began heel-toeing the accordion piece as though he were the organist at Santa Teresa. A section of the raft started expanding. When the chamber was almost bursting with air, he capped it off and repeated the process, moving around the raft's perimeter, connecting and disconnecting the hose until the boat was fully inflated.
"Remember, the river's deeper than it looks," Leo said, "and there are lots of currents. 1 minute you can be paddling straight ahead, and then before you know it, you're being swept downstream."
"Like life," Luisa thought. "You think you're headed in one direction, and all of a sudden something comes along and knocks you off course. Maybe irrevocably."
"All right, time to go," Leo said.
Luisa felt a chill ripple through her. "Does everybody remember their position?" A chorus of nods answered him. "Stand beside your place now." Her feet sliding on the river rocks, Luisa moved to the left of the bow. The strongest paddlers, Andre, a shaggy-haired whiskery guy in his 50s called Jose, and a young man whose name Luisa had missed, had been assigned to the raft's right side. Leo had explained the water would be pushing against the raft from left, and the pressure would be on the three men to keep the craft moving straight.
"Okay, on my count, we're going to pick up the raft and carry it to the edge. Use the line."
Following Leo's example, Luisa held her paddle in her left hand and with her right hand grabbed the nylon cord that ran along the perimeter tube.
3, 2, 1, lift," Leo said.
Her body canted sideways, cord cutting into her palm. Luisa crab-walked the raft with the others to the shore's edge. With Andre's help, Leo worked the boat forward until its bow bobbed on the water. "Everybody in now, one at a time, front to back," he said as he held the stern. "Luisa, you go first." Luisa stepped tentatively into the raft, feeling the rubber floor undulating with the current. As she lurched to her seat, questions that hadn't occurred to her before ran through her mind. What happens if people fall out? Should they ditch their backpacks if that happens? How do people get back in? Could the raft flip? What happens if the raft gets caught in the current or pinned against a bridge support? Oh, stop it, she told herself. The answers wouldn't matter even if she had asked the questions. Nothing would be different. Instead, she thought of Jorge and mentally scrolled through memories like they were photos on her phone. If she fell into the river, she wanted the last image in her brain to be the one of her little boy. Within moments, everyone was on board and the raft slid away from the shore. Luisa curled one hand over the paddle's T-grip and grasped halfway down the shaft with the other. Wind moved through nearby leaves, setting them in motion as though they were waving goodbye. From overhead came the hum of car tires on the asphalt. "Right side, paddle," Leo said, his whispered words almost snatched away in the wind. Andre, Jose, and the third man bent over their paddles and pulled. The raft turned toward the opposite shore where, Luisa thought, as she tried to get used to the dip and rise of the raft, the river would be called by a different name. She was leaving behind not just the safety of dry land, but an entire country, language, food, customs, most everything she'd known since birth. A pang darted through her chest. "Now everybody, paddle!" They did, silently save for their breathing. Luisa heard quick intakes of air, shallow-throated panting, ragged gasps, harsh huffs, and one blowout of shock as the raft rose and fell when a swell of water passed underneath. Evening had become night. Leo had strapped on a headlamp, and now he switched it on. The anemic beam barely illuminated the black expanse before them. As the raft moved forward, the first bridge support, it picked up speed, and Luisa could scarcely hear him over the rustle and plop of the water. "Come on, amigos, dig," Leo said, "dig." Picking out Leo's rhythmic deep inhales and exhales over the other's patterns, Luisa tried to match her breathing to his, sucking in small sips of air through her nose and puffing them out through her mouth, a metronome for her paddling. The moon cleared the treetops. Even with better light, it remained hard going. The river would be wide and slow one minute, then a narrow and perilously swift current would cut through and pull them eastward with it. The raft plowed through a cluster of tree roots and branches, bobbing as though struggling for breath. Plastic grocery bags, food wrappers, and diapers floated by, catching on their paddles. Another bridge support came into view on the right. Unlike the other ones they'd passed, this concrete pillar was chipped and scarred. Luisa tried not to think about what the rough surface could do to the raft's sleek flanks. Leo leaned hard on his steering oar. "Everyone paddle, right, double time." Luisa bent nearly double, straining as she pulled her paddle through the heavy water. The pillar drew close, the raft moving toward it as though magnetized. "Right side, I said double time. Left side, keep paddling." Luisa plunged her blade into the water and pulled it back with such ferocity, it was as though the river were an animal and she was disemboweling it. The bridge support was 3 feet away from the right bow of the aircraft, then two, then one. Rubber rasped against concrete. Luisa increased her stroke, pain radiating from her wrists. Despite the chill, sweat ran down her forehead, leaving a frosting of salt in her eyebrows. Her hands had lost feeling while her arm muscles burned as though alight. The stern of the raft cleared the pillar. Luisa felt the water relax. "Land ahead," Leo said. Luisa's numb mind grasped the words and her sore wrists
disappeared in a surge of adrenaline. Crosswinds and cross currents buffeted them, but she was oblivious, not stopping her strokes until she felt the raft run up onto hard ground beside a downed tree. Oh, she slithered over the raft's side and dropped into the water, slamming her feet against rock. The current pushed and pulled at her shins. Was the water gentler on this side? Cooler?
Pant cuffs soaked, backpack heavy against her spine, Lisa stumbled up the bank to where it leveled off, using her paddle as a crutch. Her feet were freezing and her teeth were chattering so hard she was afraid they'd crack. Her wrists, the only part of her close to warm, blazed with pain, and she didn't care.
Andre staggered up beside her. "Nouveau la fanfée?" he offered a celebratory fist. Louisa weakly bumped it with her own, blinking salt from her eyes.
"Oh, logikimos," she said. "We made it."
The group carried the raft to a spot behind a stand of trees where Leo quickly deflated it. He set the paddles and foot pump on top of the crumpled rubber and covered it with camouflage netting he'd pulled from a bag that had been secured in the stern of the boat.
"Ready for the return trip," he said, pushing the final peg into the soft earth. "Now we walk to the van. 3 miles, no lights, not even a phone screen. Border agents here."
Leo led the group through the bushes to a gravel road, where they formed a crooked line along the verge and began walking. Louisa was so weary it took all of her concentration to put one foot in front of the other without stumbling. As her feet plodded and time blurred, the question that flitted at the edge of her mind ever since she'd left home took over her thoughts. Instead of crossing again in 6 months for another supply of glucosis, what if she stayed north? Not having papers would be a problem, of course, but Louisa could follow her mother's example. There was always work to be had as an undocumented worker, especially if you were willing to take jobs citizens didn't want. She wondered what her mother would think, especially after all she'd sacrificed. There was also the matter of getting Jorge across. She could return to fetch him, but that meant paying a smuggler fee for each of them. It also meant she risked arrest, separation, and deportation not once, but twice. Leo was walking several yards in front of her. She studied the smuggler's hawk profile, erect broad shoulders and strong hands in the pre-dawn light. He had prepared the group well, stayed with them the entire trip, and led them to safety across the river. What if? Louisa lengthened her stride to catch up to him, the idea becoming clearer with every step. She could buy the glucosis, pay Leo to carry it back over the border, and deliver it to her cousin, the one watching Jorge for her. She'd stay north, find a job and a place to live, save enough to pay Leo to bring Jorge across. She reviewed the scenario once, twice in her mind. It could work. Louisa caught up to him.
Leo, she said, her tone buoyant.
He stopped, turned.
Yeah?
His jacket hung askew with one side lower. The outline of the flask was clearly visible. Louisa blinked once, twice, then shook her head.
Sorry, nothing.
Leo gave her a quizzical look.
Almost there, he resumed walking.
Louisa stayed where she was, feeling her plans sluice away, replaced by the fatigue and stress of the day. Oh, you think you're heading in one direction. 10 minutes later, the group arrived at a concrete block industrial building on an asphalt pad. Two doors, a hinged one for people and a roll-up one for vehicles, were the only breaks in the facade. There were no neighboring buildings. Louisa wasn't sure whether the place was abandoned or just closed up tight.
"This is us," Leo said.
He led them to the rear of the building, where a white panel van was parked. A man sat slumped behind the wheel. Luisa couldn't really see what he looked like, thanks to a trucker's cap pulled low and a pandemic-style mask. The van's side door hummed open. "All aboard," Leo said. The group climbed in and settled into their seats with small groans and stifled yawns, except for Luisa.
"This is where I bail," she said.
"Okay, return trip leaves at midnight." Leo climbed into the front seat beside the driver. "You miss it, no refunds."
"Got it," Luisa said.
She watched the van pull away. In the east, the sky was just beginning to bruise. Somewhere a bird chirped a few notes.
"Thanks," she said into the air when the van was out of sight. She thought about Jorge, wishing she could call him.
She removed a baggie from the pouch around her neck. Inside was a hand-drawn map. Worried about a border agent finding the info if she left it on her phone, she'd gone old school. A half hour of walking later, she was at the bus station. Two taxis waited near the entrance. Knots bunching in her shoulders, Luisa approached the first one in the queue. She gestured at the door and the driver nodded. Got in. Afraid of mispronouncing the words, she handed him the paper map over the back seat and pointed to the address written on the back. The one she'd found on the internet? The driver nodded again and started the car. Luisa kept her forehead pressed against the window during the 20-minute drive. Landscape, buildings, cars, except for the signs in a different language, much looked like what she'd left behind, or at least pretty close to it. The taxi pulled up to the dilapidated storefront. More letters were burned out than lit in the neon window signs. O24HS. Luisa tugged a small roll of local currency out of her neck pouch and peeled off the correct amount for the driver. She'd gotten the bills yesterday at a currency exchange half a block from the border motel. The store was smaller than the one she was used to, and she quickly found the correct counter. There, she carefully spoke the phrase she'd learned from the app, the one she'd practiced with Andre. Relief surged through her at the clerk's bilingual response.
6 months of generic glucosis.
Oui? $24, s'il vous plaît. The clerk smiled at Luisa. First visit to Quebec?
Moving on now to The Big Book, the Alfred Hitchcock Best of Mystery, a story by Avram Davidson, and it's called The Cost of Kent Castwell. Clem Goodhue met the train with his taxi. If old Mrs. Merriman were aboard, he would be sure of at least one passenger. Furthermore, old Mrs. Merriam had somehow gotten the idea that the minimum fare was $1. It was really 75 cents, but Clem had never been able to see a reason for telling her that. However, she was not aboard that morning. Sam Wells was. He was coming back from the city, been to put in a claim to have his pension increased. But Sam Wells wouldn't pay 5 cents to ride any distance under 5 miles. Clem disregarded him. After old Sam, a thin, brown-haired kid got off the train. Next came a girl, also thin and also brown-haired, who Clem thought was maybe a kid's teenage sister. Actually, it was the kid's mother. After that came Kent Castwell. Clem had seen him before early in the summer.
Strangers were not numerous in Ashby, particularly strangers who got ugly and caused commotion in bars. So Clem wouldn't forget him in a hurry. Big, husky fellow, always seemed to be sneering at something. But the girl and the kid hadn't been with him then.
"Taxi!" Clem called.
Caswell ignored him, began to take down luggage from the train. But the youngest girl holding the kid by the hand turned and said, "Yes, just a minute."
"Where to?"
Clem asked when the luggage was in the taxi. "The old Peabody place," the girl said. "You know where that is?"
"Yes, but nobody lives there anymore."
"Somebody does now. Us."
The big man swore as he fiddled in the handle of the right-hand door. It was tied with ropes.
Why don't you fix this thing or get a new one?"
"Costs money," Clem said. "Then Peabody Place? Have to charge you $3 for that."
"Let's go, let's go."
After they'd started off, Castwell said, "I'm giving you $2, probably twice what it's worth anyway." Half turning his head, Clem protested, "I told you, mister, it was $3.
"And I'm telling you, mister,"
Castwell mimicked the driver's New England accent, "that I'm giving you $2. Clem argued that the Peabody place was far out. He mentioned the price of gas, the bad condition of the road, the wear on the tires. The big man yawned. Then he used a word which Clem rarely used himself and never in the presence of women and children. But this young woman and child didn't seem to notice.
"Hey, stop off at the Nickerson's real estate office," Castwell said.
Levi P. Nickerson, who was also the county tax assessor, said, "Mr. Castwell, I assume this is Mrs. Castwell?"
"If that's your assumption, go right ahead," said Kent, and laughed.
It wasn't a pleasant laugh. The woman smiled faintly, so L.P. Nickerson allowed him an economic chuckle. Then he cleared his throat. City people had odd ideas of what was funny. Meanwhile, though, "Now, Mr. Castwell, about this place you're renting, I didn't realize you didn't mention that you had this little one here."
Kent said, "What if I didn't mention it? It's my own business. I haven't got all day."
Nickerson pointed out that the Peabody place stood all alone, isolated with no other house for at least a mile and no other children in the neighborhood. Mrs. Castwell, if indeed she was, said that this wouldn't be much of a matter because Kathy would be in school most of the day.
School, well, that's it, you see. The school bus, in the first place, will have to go 3 miles off what's been its regular route to pick up your little girl. And that means the road will have to be plowed regular. Snow gets real deep up in these parts, you know. Up till now, with nobody living in the old Peabody place, we never had to bother with the road. Now, well, this means," and he began to count off on his fingers. "First, it'll cost Ed Westlake. He drives a school bus more than he figured on when he bid for the contract. Second, it'll cost the county to keep your road open. That's besides the cost of this girl's schooling, which is third."
Kent Castwell said that was tough, wasn't it?
"Let's have the keys, Nick," he said.
A flicker of distaste at the familiarity crossed the real estate man's face.
"You don't seem to realize all this extra expense to the county isn't covered by the tax assessment on the Peabody place," he pointed out. "Now it just so happens that there's a house right on the outskirts of town become available this week. Miss Sarah Beach passed on, and her sister, Miss Lavinia, moved in with their married sister, Mrs. Calvin Adams. 'Twon't cost you any more, and it would save us considerable."
Castwell, sneering, got up.
"What? Me live where some old maid landlady can be on my neck all the time about messing up her pretty things? Yeah, thanks a lot. No thanks."
Held out his hand. "The keys, kid. Give me the keys."
Mr. Nickerson gave him the keys. Afterward, he was to say, and to say often, that he'd wish he'd thrown them into Lake Amastiquin instead. The income of the Castwell menage was not large and consisted of a monthly check and a monthly money order. The check came on the 15th from a city trust company and was assumed by some to be inherited income. Others argued in favor of it being a remittance paid by Castwell family to keep him away. The money order was made out to Louise Kane and signed by an army sergeant in Alaska. The young woman said this was alimony and that Sergeant Burndall was her former husband. Tom Talley at the grocery store had her sign the endorsement twice as Louise Kane and as Louise Castwell. Tom was a cautious man. Castwell gave Louise a hard time. There was no doubt about that. If she so much as walked in between the sofa on which he spent most of his time in the television, he'd leap up and belt her. More than once, both she and the kid had to run out of the house to get away from him. He wouldn't follow, as a rule, because he was barefooted, as a rule, and it was too much trouble to put his shoes on. Lie on the sofa and drink beer and watch television all afternoon, and hitch into town and drink bar whiskey and watch television all evening, that was Kent Castwell's daily schedule. He got to know who drove along the road regularly, at what time, and in which direction, and he'd be there waiting. There was more than one who could have disposed with the pleasure of his company, but he'd get out on the road and wave his arms and not move until the car he got in front of stopped. What could you do about it? Put him in jail? Well, sure you could. He hadn't been living here a week before he got into a fight at Ashby Bar, disturbing the peace, using profane and abusive language, and resisting arrest. That will be $10 or 10 days on each of the charges, said Judge Paltiel Bradford. And count yourself lucky it's not more. Pay the clerk. But Castwell, his ugly leer in no way improved by the dirt and bruises on his face, said, I'll take the jail. Judge Bradford's long jaw set, then loosened. Look here, Mr. Castwell, that was just legal language on my part. The jail is closed up. Hasn't been anybody in there since July. It was then November. It would have to be heated and illuminated and the water turned on and a guard hired, to say nothing of feeding you. Now, I don't see why the county should put to all that expense on your account. You pay the clerk $30. You haven't got it on you. Take till tomorrow. Well, I'll take the jail. Well, it's most inconvenient. Well, that's too bad, Your Honor. The judge glared at him. Camille Coolidge, the district attorney, stood up. Perhaps the court would care to suspend sentence, he suggested, seeing it is the defendant's first offense. The court did care, but the next week Kent was back again on the same charge. Altogether, the sentence now came to $60 or 60 days, and again Castwell chose jail. I don't generally do this, the judge said, fuming, but I'll let you pay your fine off in installments, considering you have a wife and a child. I'll take jail. You won't like the food, warned His Honor. Castwell said he guessed the food would be up to the legal requirements. If it wasn't, he said the State Board of Prison Inspectors would hear about it. Some pains were taken to see that the food served Kent during his stay in jail was beyond the legal requirements, if not much beyond. The last time the state board had inspected the county jail, it had cost the taxpayers $200 in repairs. It was costing them quite enough to incarcerate Ken Castwell, as it was, although the judge had reduced the cost by ordering the sentences to run concurrently. All in all, Kent spent over a month in jail that winter at various times. It seemed to some that whenever his money ran out, he let the county support him and let the woman and child fend for themselves. Tom Talley gave them a little credit at the store. Not much.
Ed Westlake, when he bid again for the school bus contract, added the cost of going 3 miles out of his way to pick up Kathy. The county had no choice but to meet the extra charge. It was considered very thoughtless of Louise to wait until after the contract was signed before leaving Castwell and going back to the city with her child. The side road to the Peabody place didn't have to be plowed so often, but it still had to be plowed some. That extra cost, just for one man, it was maddening. It also seemed, no, it did seem, as if Kent Castwell was deliberately setting himself in the face of New England respectability and thrift. The sacred words, eat it up, wear it out, make it do or do without, didn't mean a thing to him. He wasn't just indifferent. He was hostile. Ashby was not a thriving place. It had no industries. It was not a resort town, being far from sea and mountain alike, with only the shallow, muddy waters of Lake Amastaquit for a pleasure spot. Its thin-soiled farms and meager woodlots produced a scant return for the hard labor exacted. The young people continued to leave. Kent Castwell, unfortunately, showed no signs of leaving. All things considered, it was not surprising that Ashby had no artist colony. It was rather surprising, then, that Clem Goodhue, meeting the train with his taxi, recognized Bob Laurel at once as an artist. When asked afterwards how he had known, Clem looked smug and said that he'd once been to Providencetown. The conversation, as Clem recalled it afterwards, began with Bob Laurel's asking where he could find a house which offered low rent, peace and quiet, and a place to paint. "So I recommended Kent Castwell," Clem said. He was talking to Sheriff Erastus Nickerson, Levi P.'s cousin, at the time. "Peace and quiet," the sheriff repeated. "I know Laurel's a city fella and an artist, but still, and all." They were seated in the bar of the Ashby House, drinking their weekly small glass of beer. "I looked at it this way, Erastus," the taxi man said. "Sure, there's empty houses all around that he could rent. Suppose he, this artist fellow, suppose he picks one off of the side road with nobody else living on it. Suppose he comes up with a wife out of somewhere, and suppose she has a school-aged child." "Oh, you're right, Clem." "Of course I'm right. Bad enough for the county to be put to all that cost for one house, let alone two." "You are right, Clem. But will he stay with Castwell?" Clem shrugged. "That I can't say, but I did my best." Laurel stayed with Castwell. He really had no choice. The big man agreed to take him in as a lodger and to give over the front room for a studio. And, holding out offers of insulating the house, putting in another window, and who knows what else, Kent Castwell persuaded the unwary artist to pay several months' rent in advance. Needless to say, he drank up the money and did nothing at all in the way of promised improvements. Neither District Attorney Gamaliel Coolidge nor Sheriff Nickerson, nor, for that matter, anyone else, showed Laurel much sympathy. He had grounds for a civil suit, they said, nothing else. It should be a lesson to him to not throw his money around in the future, they said. So the unhappy artist stayed on at the old Peabody place, buying his own food and cutting his own wood and painting, painting, painting. All the time he knew full well that his leering landlord only waited for him to go into town in order to help himself to both food and wood. Laurel invited Clem to have a glass of beer with him more than once, just to have somebody to tell his troubles to. Besides stealing his food and fuel, Kent Castwell, it seemed, played the TV at full blast when Laurel wanted to sleep. If it was too late for TV, he set the radio to roaring.
At moments when the artist was intent on delicate brushwork, Castwell would decide to bring in stove wood and drop it on the floor so that the whole house shook. "He talks to himself in that loud, rough voice of his," Bob Laurel complained. "He has a filthy mouth. He makes fun of my painting. I tell you what it is," Clem said. "Kent Castwell has no consideration for others. That's what it is. Yep." Bets were taken in town of a 10-cent cigar bet on how long Laurel would stand for it. Levi Nickerson, the county tax assessor, thought he'd leave as soon as his rent was up. Clem's opinion was that he'd leave sooner. "Money don't mean much to city people," he pointed out. Clem won. When he came into Nickerson's house, Levi, who was sitting close to the small fire in the kitchen stove, wordlessly handed over the cigar. Clem nodded, put it in his pocket. Mrs. Abby Nickerson sat next to her husband wearing a man's sweater. It had belonged to her late father, whose heart had failed to survive the first re-election of Franklin D. Roosevelt, and it still had a lot of wear left in it. Abby was unraveling old socks and winding the wool into a bar. "Waste not, want not," was her motto, as well as that of every other old-time local resident. "Where is he?" the tax assessor asked. "Laurel? In the Ashby bar? He's all packed. I told him to stay put. I told them to keep an eye on him. Phone me here if he made a move to leave." He took out a sheet of paper out of his pocket and put it on the table. Levi looked at it, but made no move to pick it up. To his wife he said, "I'm expecting Erastus and Gam Coolidge over, Mrs. Nickerson. County business, I expect you can find something to do in the front of the house while we talk." Mrs. Levi nodded. Even words were not wasted. A car drove up to the house. "That's Erastus," said his cousin. "Gam should be along. He is along. Might have known he wouldn't waste gasoline and came with Erastus." The two men came into the kitchen. Mrs. Abby Nickerson arose and departed. "Hope we can get this over with before nightfall," the sheriff said. "I don't like to drive after dark if I can help it. One of my headlights is getting dim, and they cost so darn much to replace." Clem cleared his throat. "Well, here 'tis," he said, gesturing to the paper on the table. "Laurel's confession. Tell the sheriff and the DA that I am ready to give myself up," he says. "I wrote it all down here," he says. "Happened about 2 o'clock this afternoon, I guess. Straw that broke the camel's back, Kent Castwell. He was acting up as usual, stomping and swearing out there at the Peabody place. Words were exchanged. Laurel left to go out back." Clem said delicately, not needing no further comment on the Peabody place's lack of indoor plumbing. "When he come back, Castwell had taken the biggest brush he could find and smeared paint all over the pictures Laurel had been working on, ruined them completely." There was a moment of silence. "Castwell had no call to do that," the sheriff said. "Destroying another man's property. They tell me some of those artists get as much as $100 for a painting. What'd he do then? Laurel, I mean. Picked up a piece of stove wood and hit him with it. Hit him hard." "No doubt about his being dead, I suppose?" the sheriff asked. Clem shook his head. "There was no blood or anything on the wood," he added. "Just another piece of stove wood. But he's dead, all right." After a moment, Levi Nickerson said, "His wife will have to be notified. No reason why the county should have to pay burial expenses. I expect she won't have any money, though. Best to get in touch with those trustees who sent Castwell his money every month. They'll pay." Gamaliel Coolidge asked if anyone else knew. Clem said no. Bob Laurel hadn't told anyone else. He didn't seem to want to talk. This time, there was a longer silence. "Do you realize how much Kent Castwell cost this county, one way or the other?" Nickerson asked. Clem said he supposed hundreds of dollars, hundreds and hundreds of dollars, Nickerson said. "And," the tax assessor went on, "do you know what it will cost us to try this fellow for murder in any degree or manslaughter?" The district attorney said it would cost thousands, thousands and thousands. "And that's just the trial," he elaborated. "Suppose he's found guilty and appeals. We'd be obliged to fight the appeal. More thousands, and suppose he gets a new trial. We'd have to pay it all over again.
Levi P. Nickerson opened his mouth as though it hurt him to do so. What it would do to the county at tax rate, he groaned. Kent Castwell, he said, his voice becoming crisp and definitive, is not worth it. He is just not worth it.
Clem took out the 10-cent cigar he'd won, sniffed it.
My opinion, he said, it would have been much better if this feral Laurel had just packed up and left. Anybody finding Castwell's body would assume he'd fallen and hit his head. But this confession, now...
Sheriff Erastus Nickerson said reflectively,
I haven't read any confession. You, Gam? You, Levi?
No.
What you've told us, Clem, is just hearsay. Can't act on hearsay. Totally contrary to the principles of American law,
Mighty nice sunset.
He arose and walked over to the window. His cousin followed him, and so did District Attorney Coolidge. While they were looking at the sunset, Clem Goodhue, after a single glance at their backs, took the sheet of paper from the kitchen table and thrust it into the kitchen stove. There was a flare of light. It quickly died down. Clem carefully reached his hand into the stove, took out the small corner of the paper remaining, and lit his cigar with it. The three men turned from the window. Levi P. Nickerson was first to speak.
Can't ask any of you to stay for supper, he said. Just a few leftovers is all we're having. I expect you'll want to be going on your way.
The two other county officials nodded. The taxi man said,
I believe I'll stop by the Ashby Bar. Might be someone there wanting to catch the evening train.
Night, Levi. Don't turn on the yard light for us.
Wasn't going to, said Levi. Turning them on and off, well, that's what burns them out.
Night, Clem, Gam, Erastus.
He closed the door after them.
Mrs. Nickerson, he called to his wife, you can come and start supper now. We finished our business.
Well, good and wonderful people, that's going to do it for this episode of the Mystery Hour. Thanks for tuning in to Sun Sounds of Arizona, and Keith Tyler asking you to tune in once again, if you please. Make sure your I love yous are in order. Thanks. So long.